of Barbara Stocking calls for openness and global regulation of commodities markets to prevent damaging speculation.
There's a complete lack of transparency in the food market as to where food is, where the grain supplies are, and so on. So the first thing is to get real openness in that. The second thing is to get some controls on the great fluctuations in prices which hit poor people the hardest. The idea that we have derivatives in food is just absolutely appalling.
The charity says one out of seven people is currently hungry and warns if nothing's done to increase yield and reduce prices, the crisis will become cataclysmic in 30 years. For NPR News, I'm Larry Miller in London.
I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Economic Development Authority of Fairfax County, Virginia, home to creative people and creative companies at powerofideas.org.
WILL programs are made possible by Auditory Care Center, an independent hearing care center serving Champaign, Piatt, Ford, Vermilion, and other East Central Illinois counties. Auditory Care Center offers hearing evaluations as well as selection, fitting, and repair of hearing aids at 892-5959 in Rantoul.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer. Kyle Mabry is at the controls. For this hour, we go to the archives for a program we first broadcast in March. That means that during this hour of Focus, we'll not be taking calls. The U.S. Detention Center at Guantanamo Bay is at the center of the debate about how we handle people who are suspected of terrorism. But our guest for this hour, Jonathan Hafitz, professor of law at Seton Hall University, says that Guantanamo should not be viewed in isolation. He says it is part of a larger global system that is designed to operate outside the law. And this morning, in this hour, we will look at the rise of this global system and also the effort to challenge it. And that is the subject of a recent book published by Jonathan Hafitz. The title of his book is Habeas Corpus After 9/11, Confronting America's New Global Detention System. The New York University Press is the publisher. Jonathan Hafitz is Associate Professor of Law at Seton Hall University School of Law. He's litigated in some leading habeas corpus detention cases. And Professor Hafitz, hello.
Hi.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
I appreciate it. I think to start, I would go a little bit out of order than you deal with the subject in your book and right up front ask about habeas corpus to make sure that people understand the idea. Maybe you can explain in the simplest possible terms what habeas corpus is about.
Habeas corpus is the word for an old writ. It goes back centuries into England and came to America, with the colonists and was made part of our Constitution and has been with us since the very beginning. And basically what it does is it's a device for a prisoner who's being held by the government to get access to a court and to require that the government demonstrate a basis to a judge for holding that person. So if you think about it, it's really a critical safeguard of individual liberty and check on abusive government power. You know, if the government, the police, the military, whomever, lock someone up, habeas corpus is the vehicle or the means by which that person is able to get before a judge, and that the government has to justify the detention and show that it's based in law.
Mm. And that's if people are interested in the history of it, how it is it developed that as an idea, they can look at your book and read about that. But I think the important thing is, as you have said, that this is an old idea. It comes into the United States, into U.S. law, by the way of English law, and it is something that is actually written into the U.S. Constitution.
Exactly, and it's written into the Constitution through a provision that's referred to as the suspension clause, and what it basically says is that the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended except in the gravest of emergencies, time of invasion or rebellion, where the public safety requires it. So, absent these exceptional circumstances, habeas corpus is to remain available. And there was really no debate about this by the individuals who founded the country and framed our Constitution. And the only question was whether habeas should ever be suspended at all. Mm. What was written into the Constitution was a very limited provision for suspending access to this writ. But as long as the courts are open, the idea is that we should have habeas corpus, and we should be able to ensure that the jailer has to justify the detention to a court.
Yeah. Well, then let me ask you what seems to be a key question, and I realize that it's an easy question to pose, and it's a much more complicated question to answer, and you spend a lot of time in the book answering the question, but here it is. To whom does habeas corpus apply?
Well, it's a great question, and I think it's a question that's central to a lot of the, if not all of the legal battles that have been waged after 9/11, because the idea, no one really contested what habeas corpus meant, or the idea of habeas corpus. The question was, who had a right to habeas corpus?
Mm-hmm.
And the battle over Guantanamo, for example, has been on for many years, was whether non-citizens who are being held outside of the sovereign territory of the United States, that is, in territory that's not formally part of the United States, should have access to the courts through habeas corpus. And that question has been the subject of really three Supreme Court decisions until finally, most recently, the court definitively said that, yes, prisoners at Guantanamo must have access to habeas corpus. And the fact that they're not citizens, or that they're not being held in the continental United States or in territory that's formally part of the United States does not necessarily make a difference.
Mm-hmm. And we can we'll go on and we'll talk about some of these cases in a little bit more detail. But maybe let me ask another question. Were there even points at which some people argued that habeas corpus did not even apply to non-citizens who were actually in the United States?
Yes and no. It's basically what the position was, and this came, the government's position, the Bush administration's position principally, was manifested with respect to really three of the detainees who were held in the United States after 9/11. Jose Padilla, who was an American citizen, Yasser Hamdi, who was an American citizen, and then Ali Almari, who was a legal resident who I represented, who was also held in the United States. Hamdi had been captured in Afghanistan and then brought to the United States by way of Guantanamo. Padilla and Almari were both arrested in the country. Padilla at O'Hare Airport in Chicago, Almari in Peoria, Illinois, at his home, and both were placed into military custody and held as enemy combatants. Now, what the Bush administration said was that all three had access to the courts, but it was a very, very limited view of what habeas corpus was. It was almost a rubber stamp for the detention. Basically, that if as long as the government presented some evidence, just a statement by a intelligence or a military official to a judge, the judge would have to approve the detention, and that the prisoners or the petitioners would have no opportunity to be heard. They wouldn't even have access to a lawyer. So it was almost formally the answer is yes, there was habeas corpus, but it was effectively reduced to almost a rubber stamp. Mm. And so in practice, it was a gutting of the writ. So the threat was not just to non-citizens outside the United States, but even potentially to American citizens and legal immigrants inside the country. Yeah.
Just real quick, I'd like to introduce again our guest, Jonathan Hafitz. He is Associate Professor of Law at Seton Hall University School of Law, and we're talking about his book, Habeas Corpus After 9/11, Confronting America's New Global Detention System. It is published by the New York University Press. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. So let's talk just a little bit more about Guantanamo. After 9/11, the United States apprehended a number of individuals in Afghanistan and actually elsewhere, places where there really wasn't any fighting going on, all people that the government said it suspected of being involved in terrorism. And many of these people were confined at Guantanamo Bay, and I guess hundreds of people have passed through there. One of the things that you said is that this was a deliberate choice, Guantanamo Bay, and then other places outside the United States. These were deliberate choices made as places for detainees because they were not inside the United States. And then it goes back to this idea that they were going to make this argument that, well, yeah, habeas corpus doesn't apply to people who are being held outside of the United States.
Yeah, I mean, it was a very deliberate, calculated choice to hold prisoners at Guantanamo as opposed to bringing them to the United States. And this is laid out in a series of Justice Department memoranda written by John Yoo and others, which were initially secret but subsequently leaked in around 2004. And what they say is that, you know, basically, if we bring prisoners who we capture in Afghanistan and elsewhere as part of the war on terror to Guantanamo, we can argue that they don't have access to U.S. courts, because Guantanamo is, even though it's controlled by the United States completely, Guantanamo Bay, the military base, we have possession of it through a lease with Cuba and a series of lease agreements that date back about 100 years, under which Cuba retains formal sovereignty. So it's sort of like the fine print, you know, when they say read the fine print on a contract. I mean, that's sort of what it is. It's the fine print. It looks like the United States. It feels like the United States. The U.S. is total control. But technically, in terms of the fine print, this is actually belongs to Cuba. And so the sort of argument, the clever argument, I think, and very problematic argument was, well, we'll bring them to Guantanamo, where we have total control over the facility and over the prisoners, but we'll be able to argue that the prisoners don't have access to U.S. courts, so U.S. courts can't examine their detention, they can't examine their treatment, they can't determine whether the U.S. is complying with the Constitution or the Geneva Conventions. They can't do anything because it's technically not part of the United States. Mm. And that was the genesis of the idea of bringing prisoners to Guantanamo after 9/11.
And just to one further point here, and I have a caller I'm going to get to the designation of enemy combatants using this term. It's sort of my understanding, at least in the past, that essentially that term, it was synonymous with soldier. You know, that an enemy combatant was a soldier. At least it meant people who were covered by the law of war. But the administration, they said no. They were meaning something entirely different, for which I think there wasn't much precedent, saying, well, these people actually, they weren't covered by the Geneva Convention.
Exactly. It was a derivation from a established term, the idea of combatant or prisoner of war, that was recognized under the Geneva Conventions as a soldier who could be detained during armed conflict but had rights and protections. And the idea was the Bush administration sort of twisted the term and said, well, these are combatants. They're like the old combatants, the traditional combatants, the prisoners of war, that they can be detained, but they're not prisoners of war because they're not being detained in connection with a armed conflict, i.e. the war on terror, that's subject to the Geneva Conventions, and so they don't have any legal protections. So we can hold them, but they are, in effect, outside the law. So what you see at Guantanamo is you have the creation of both a place that's outside the courts and a category of persons that's outside the protections of the law, domestic law as well as international law, the Geneva Conventions. And that's why, you know, I refer and others have referred to Guantanamo as a prison beyond the law.
Yeah, so it seems what you end up here is in a place where you say the detainees aren't covered by any law at all.
Exactly. Another way to put it, it's a legal black hole.
Yeah. Well, I have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Let us do that. Someone who is here in Champaign County, where we are. This is Line 1. Hello.
Hi. I think you went to Afghanistan, right? You did a brief for the ACLU about conditions there. And I'm just, I know that some defenders of the draconian policy that are still going on say that, well, you know, it's a war zone, and we have to do it. And I think that you would probably go as I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think that you would say that even particularly because of the particular circumstance of how Afghanistan came about as a war zone, that it too needs to have a regime that recognizes that human rights should prevail there as well. Is that too diffuse for you, or can I?
No, I mean, I think that's basically, you know, my sense, and I've worked on cases involving prisoners in Afghanistan, both who are held there now and at Guantanamo. I've not actually been there, so just to qualify. But the problem is that Afghanistan, the U.S. detention center at Bagram, or at Parwan, as it's now known, is a place where there continues to be no. No judicial review, and there also are, you know, I think procedures that have improved materially under the Obama administration, but are still problematic in a number of respects, including, for example, the independence of the decision makers and the lack of access to classified information. So I think you see, some of the problems that we saw in Guantanamo and previously at Bagram continuing in Afghanistan, and I think it's part of, as I say, you know, it's part of this larger system of security detentions that are conducted outside the courts.
Right, and Bagram is as bad as Guantanamo, perhaps worse in some ways. And there's a supposition, I think, that you implied there, that there are zones and black areas on the map where the U.S. is doing this. Through CIA and various other factors, maybe some privatized prisons like we do here. It just seems that there's just so much that isn't known. And I gather one of the things your group and the ACLU have been trying to do is to do Freedom of Information Act, but when it's out of the country and run mainly by the Pentagon or some other agency that's been in expected to have a complete run of the show without any oversight, we're not confident of what actually is going on. I thank you very much for your work.
All right. Well, thank you. I want to, again, tell people that are listening, questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Maybe now we should talk just a little bit more about these three Supreme Court cases where people were coming before the court and were making the argument that, in fact, habeas did cover the people that were housed at, detained at Guantanamo. And then there seemed to be a jockeying back and forth between the people who were arguing for the rights of the detainees, the court and how it was considering those rights, and then the Congress, which at least a couple of times continued to undercut the rights of the detainees and undercut the decisions of the court. So here basically we've got three rulings here. The first one was in 2004, where essentially the question was, well, do the detainees have a right to habeas? And in that particular case, the U.S. Supreme Court said yes, although this was a pretty narrow ruling, and they really didn't address a lot of the other big questions that were involved.
Right. The first ruling was the 2004 ruling in Rasul versus Bush, recognized that the Guantanamo detainees had a right to habeas corpus, but they didn't. They grounded the right in a federal statute, in the habeas corpus statute, which had been on the books since 1789, in effect, and they didn't address the question directly of whether the detainees had a right under the Constitution. And the practical significance of that is, if the right is based only in statute, Congress can potentially amend the statute and take away the right. Whereas if it's a right that's based in the Constitution, it's something that Congress can take away, at least absent a valid suspension of the writ. So that is that invocation of emergency powers, which Congress has not invoked, and I don't think plausibly could invoke with respect to Guantanamo. So Rasul said that detainees have a right under federal statute to habeas corpus. What you then had after 2004 was Congress twice amending the habeas statute to try to take away the Guantanamo detainees' right to go to court through habeas corpus. It did it first in 2005 through what was called the Detainee Treatment Act, and there the Supreme Court ruled in the second of the Guantanamo trilogy of decisions, Hamdan versus Rumsfeld, that this statute, this new law, didn't affect existing or pending habeas petitions. So it interpreted the Detainee Treatment Act in a narrow way to preserve the jurisdiction it had recognized in the first case, the Rasul case, to say basically this only applies to future filed cases. It doesn't actually apply to pending cases. So the court was able to consider the case in Hamdan, which involved the military commissions or war crimes tribunals. So after that, in 2006, Congress, almost immediately went back and said, okay, we're going to try again, but this time we're not going to leave any doubt. We're going to, and it made, completely clear that it was amending the habeas statute to say that Guantanamo detainees had no right to habeas corpus, regardless of whether their case was pending at the time or was a future case, but made very clear the statute didn't cover them. So this set up the third and last of the three Guantanamo detainee decisions, Boumediene versus Bush, which was decided in 2008, which said, addressed whether the Congress had violated the suspension clause, the Constitution's guarantee of habeas corpus, by taking it away from Guantanamo detainees. And there the court said that it did violate the suspension clause, and it ruled as part of that decision that Guantanamo detainees had a constitutional right to habeas corpus, even though they were non-citizens and even though they were detained outside the sovereign territory of the United States. And that was a very important ruling, and sort of made definitively clear, at least with respect to Guantanamo, that habeas corpus protections applied.
Yeah, and since that time, a number of challenges have been made, and a number of people they got lawyers, and courts did indeed find that there was no lawful basis for their detention.
Right, so after, in the last, almost 3 years now since the Boumediene decision in 2008, all the individual habeas cases that have been filed, many which were filed as far back as, early 2002, started to actually go forward, and the detainees actually started to have hearings, which none had before federal judges. And it's remarkable, actually, in those cases, of the 58 cases that have been decided by district courts, in, I believe, 37 of those 58 cases, the judges found that there was no lawful basis for the detention. Now it gets a little more complicated because the Court of Appeals has taken a more restrictive view and reversed several of those decisions. But it's very clear from even taking into account the circuit court that there were a lot of problems in the detentions at Guantanamo, and that when the government was finally forced to justify it through a legal process to a court, it was unable to do so. And these are the remaining cases. So, these are the remaining 200 or so cases, or 230 where we started Obama. We're down to 170 now. So, presumably these are some of the government's, strongest cases. Many of the other prisoners, approximately 500, had been previously released without any court order.
So, as a result of this of these cases, and I suppose the most, as you say, the most important one was the third and last one, the Boumediene case. Then finally, lawyers could start going to Guantanamo, and the people who are being held there had the opportunity to have some representation and to challenge their detention. I think one of the points that you try to make in the book is that though you shouldn't just think about Guantanamo. We know about Guantanamo; it's not a secret. But then I suppose the question is, well, what other places are there people being held that either we don't know about or it's very difficult to get information about, and whether or not they're now getting the same kind of protections to whatever extent they're getting them that they're getting in Guantanamo.
Right. I mean, if you have to think about Guantanamo in a sense as a as part of a larger archipelago of detention operations after 9/11, the most visible among them. But as I said, it was only a part, and we had, you know, the U.S. was and continues to conduct detention operations at Bagram. Many of the individuals that are currently detained there were seized in Afghanistan, but a number were not. A number were brought to Bagram from elsewhere. In addition, during the Bush administration, we had a detentions that took place at secret CIA facilities, sometimes called black sites, which were the most secretive and where the most or the worst abuses in terms of treatment and torture took place. So, you know, and then we also had the military detentions in the United States of three individuals who were held as enemy combatants in the United States. So the idea was that the United States was fighting a global war on terror, that the entire world was effectively a battlefield, and that individuals seized anywhere, not just in Afghanistan where there was fighting, but elsewhere, thousands of miles from the front, could be detained and held as an enemy combatant indefinitely without criminal charge and without any real access to the courts.
Let me introduce again our guests for anyone who perhaps has just tuned in the last 5 or 10 minutes. We are talking with Jonathan Hafetz. He is Associate Professor of Law at Seton Hall University School of Law and has litigated a number of leading habeas corpus detention cases. Before going to Seton Hall, he was an attorney at the ACLU's National Security Project. He also lectures widely on civil liberties and human rights and is the author of the book Habeas Corpus: After 9/11, Confronting America's New Global Detention System, and it is published by the New York University Press. Early on, I think that the Bush administration announced its intention to try people who were accused of terrorism and to not to try them in civilian court, but to try them in military tribunals, in military commissions. And there have been, I think that it's true, there have actually been some of these military trials held at Guantanamo Bay.
Yes, there have been a few of the trials have been held at Guantanamo Bay, a few under President Bush, and three proceedings that were completed that were ongoing before completed under under President Obama. Most of them have resulted in or resulted in plea bargains, where the detainee essentially, you know, pled to a law of war violation and received, you know, a sentence, typically a little additional time, and then repatriation to his home country.
And there is there any basis for challenging the legality of the military tribunals?
Well, certainly. I mean, we have a number of iterations of these military tribunals or military commissions, and these are you know, as I talk about in the book, these are part of the detention system at Guantanamo. You really have kind of two facets. You have people who are detained indefinitely as enemy combatants, as they're not charged with a crime. They're just held to prevent their, you know, return to the battlefield, as it were, in the war on terror. And then you have a subset of that larger group who are then charged with military commissions, which for committing what are considered war crimes, although that's in itself problematic in terms of how that's defined. But you have these two groups. You have the indefinite detention group, and then you have the group that's charged for military commissions. And we have a number of iterations of the military commissions up to the present. The first commissions were created by President Bush by an executive order in November of 2001. Those commissions were challenged. And one of the consequences of the Rasool decision, the 2004 Supreme Court decision, first Supreme Court decision on habeas, meant that detainees who were put before military commissions could bring challenges to those commissions in federal court through habeas corpus. And that happened with one of the first detainees who was being put through the commissions, a Yemeni national named Salim Hamdan. Hamdan had been charged with violating the law of war. He was alleged to have been Osama bin Laden's personal driver, but he brought a habeas corpus challenge to the military commissions, saying that they violated federal law, they violated the Uniform Code of Military Justice, because they presented essentially a second-class system of military justice, and they also violated our obligations under the Geneva Conventions. And the case, that case went to the Supreme Court and became the second of the three Supreme Court Guantanamo decisions, the Hamdan versus Rumsfeld case. And in that case, the Supreme Court ruled that the military commissions created by President Bush were not valid, that they essentially lacked congressional authorization, and they violated the Geneva Conventions. So what happened next was that Congress then, a few months later, through the Military Commissions Act, reinstituted or created new military commissions. That was the law that also tried to take away habeas corpus for the second time. But it also created these new military commissions, created some improvements, but most importantly, made clear that this time the commissions had congressional backing. So in other words, no longer was it simply, you know, the president creating war crimes tribunals on his own, but now it was the two political branches, the executive and Congress, acting together to create this military commission system, which made them, in effect, more difficult to challenge, despite some of their continuing problems. There were several people who were charged before these new military commissions, and then essentially you had the election and Obama come in, and then although Obama initially suspended all military commission proceedings following his inauguration, he rescinded that suspension, helped put through a new Military Commissions Act, the 09 Commissions Act, which made some further improvements to the system, and then they've been now more detainees are being put through this new system. So you have basically a new law, or a law that's now in its third or fourth iteration, providing for military commissions, and we have more detainees, and I expect more to come with the resumption of filing of or the elimination of the bar on filing new charges before military commissions. So, in effect, the commissions are kind of up and back and running, and so I expect to see a lot of legal issues get worked out in the context of those cases, and possibly down the road with another Supreme Court case.
Mm. Well, let's talk some more about the Obama administration and Guantanamo. When he was running for office, before he was president, President Obama said that he would close Guantanamo Bay. And once elected, the administration set up a task force to try to review the cases of the people that remain. And I think now there are still 172 people there. And I think what perhaps disappointed a lot of people was that it's essentially what they did was that they carried on the Bush administration policy, saying, well, we still have some people here we think that we can try, and we'd like to try some of those people in military tribunals. And then they said, but, we also think there are some people here we just can't let go. Then that gets into another series of questions about what you do with those people. So, is it fair to say that essentially what the Obama administration is doing, as far as Guantanamo is concerned, and the people there who are detained, is this essentially it's the same thing that the Bush administration was doing?
I think yes and no. I think it's a continuation in many respects of the Bush administration policy on Guantanamo as it developed and was moderated in a sense by litigation in the court. So it's kind of a continuation of what was happening in the late Bush administration years. I think it's a little bit different than some of the of what was happening in the early administration years of the administration, where there was widespread abuse of prisoners at Guantanamo, people being brought to Guantanamo to avoid jurisdiction. That said, you do have a continuation of some key aspects of the Bush administration war on terror, mainly the idea of indefinite detention. That is, that there's this group of individuals at Guantanamo whom the United States is not going to try in any forum, but simply going to hold on to. Based on the idea that they present a danger. So this category of individuals who are supposedly too dangerous to release but too difficult to try. So you have so that indefinite detention, which is a key feature of Guantanamo, continues. In addition, you have the use of military commissions. Now, the Obama administration's made some additional reforms, including to access to evidence, limiting the use of hearsay. But nonetheless, we have the commission still suffer from some of the same flaws. They're trying individuals for what are called war crimes that aren't actually war crimes, such as providing support for terrorism. They continue to provide a second class or a process or a lesser process than you would get in either the established military courts, the court-martials, or federal civilian courts, the criminal courts. And in addition, they continue to suffer from a legitimacy deficit. The commissions have been widely denounced, widely criticized, and I think that they lack a credibility, and yet the Obama administration has continued to use them. Now, what's interesting is what's happened is the Obama administration's options have been, I think, narrowed significantly by Congress. Over the past 2 years, Congress has placed significant restrictions on the Obama administration and any effort it was going to take to close the facility. It's prohibited the administration from bringing prisoners to the United States, even now bringing them to the United States for criminal trial. So it's closed off the potential avenue of putting Guantanamo detainees on trial in federal courts, which I think is the best and the way that those detainees should have been handled, who the administration was going to detain. But that's been closed off. And restrictions on transferring prisoners to other countries, bars on bringing prisoners to the United States for any purpose, continued detention or release. So you now have a situation where I think it's in many ways we're further today from closing Guantanamo than we were in 2009 when Obama took office.
Yeah. Well, there, as you say, the administration did open up this possibility, this interest and willingness to bring Guantanamo Bay detainees to the United States for trial in U.S. court, and there's been one. They did one. That was Ahmed Gailani, who was tried in January in New York, and he was sentenced to life in prison without parole for his involvement in the embassy bombings that took place in Africa in 1998. And that was the first time that a Guantanamo Bay detainee had been tried in U.S. civilian court. And now, as you say, that's doesn't look like anytime soon that's going to happen again. What was the justification that Congress gave for closing that off?
Well, the impetus was, the main impetus was the announcement by Attorney General Holder in late 2009 that the administration was going to bring Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and four others involved in the actual plotting of 9/11 to federal court and try them in a federal court in New York. Mm-hmm. And that created an enormous backlash. I think there was not sufficient planning done by the administration in terms of securing local support in New York, and I think there was a perhaps a naivete about how Congress might respond. But in any event, there was this a significant backlash, and that ultimately led to legislation that now prohibits the president from trying Guantanamo detainees in federal court. And I think the Congress's justifications, I think are weak. Congress, basically says that the idea that, well, if you put a detainee on trial in federal court, the detainee might not be convicted. That's simply just a consequence of the idea of a fair trial. I mean, any fair trial, you don't know the outcome beforehand, otherwise the trial's rigged and not fair. But there's also a larger sense which has pervaded the entire Guantanamo situation and Congress's response to Guantanamo, that the Guantanamo detainees they shouldn't have the same rights as American citizens. And also, finally, that this is a war. I think that's perhaps the most significant justification, or the one you hear the most, that this is a war. Terrorism is a war. And so in a war, we shouldn't be giving detainees full due process rights. And I think it goes back to the whole idea of treating people as enemy combatants. and creating alternative second-class justice systems. And I think that these are some of the justifications offered in defense of this legislation, which is really incredible. I mean, it basically says we have some people at Guantanamo, at least a few, who are suspected of involvement in the worst terrorist plot in U.S. history, like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And yet Congress has said to the president, you can't put these individuals on trial, at least not in federal court, where we've tried hundreds of terrorists and of which have proven the most effective way of bringing terrorists to justice. It's a, it's a system that's really beyond criticism. I mean, there are criticisms sometimes in how trials are handled, but no one's saying the federal courts lack legitimacy. So they're legitimate, they're fair, and they are remarkably successful at having terrorist suspects prosecuted consistent with security. And yet the Congress has taken that tool away from the president. It's an incredibly dangerous move by the Congress.
We have a caller here to bring in Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm interested in how one can make any argument at all for these trials, the tribunal trials, on the grounds that the Bill of Rights, particularly Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendment, are all there to limit what the federal government can do in trials. And yet it seems that this entire system simply ignores that, simply says that, in some cases, the federal government can do things that it's specifically prohibited from doing by the Bill of Rights. Can such an argument pass any sort of constitutional test?
Well, I think it's a real problem with the commissions, that the military tribunals, that they don't, adhere to the Bill of Rights. And in fact, I think the entire genesis of the commissions, if you go back, and of holding prisoners at Guantanamo, was to avoid the Bill of Rights.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah,
I mean, that idea was holding them without trial or trying them in military commissions at Guantanamo was a way to avoid the Bill of Rights. Because if you brought them to the United States and you charged them with a crime, they would be entitled to the Bill of, clearly entitled to the protections of the Bill of Rights. Now, as I said, the commissions have improved some over the years, but they, in some respects, still don't meet the standards of the Bill of Rights. And the real question in the military commission cases, which we'll see in future litigation, is whether the courts determine that the Bill of Rights applies to Guantanamo or which provisions. All the Supreme Court has said so far is that the habeas corpus suspension clause applies to Guantanamo, so that Guantanamo detainees can get access to a court,
right,
and make their arguments and have a hearing on their detention. But the court has not decided whether the full Bill of Rights applies or the applicable provisions governing criminal trials apply, and which one of those provisions apply. So I think you're going to see, as these, as there are more commission cases and they start working their way through the courts, a lot of challenges to the commissions based on the argument that they don't meet the standards for the Bill of Rights.
And the larger question: how does the federal government assume the right to set up trials generally under the Universal Code of Military Justice if that code does not comply with the Bill of Rights? I mean, how did they get out of it in the first place, so to speak?
Well, I mean, I think the idea that of a separate military justice system is one that's, there's a long history to it, but
yeah,
it's essentially been upheld, but it's limited. I mean, the Uniform Code of Military Justice is the idea that it's limited, its jurisdiction is limited, and it doesn't have jurisdiction over civilians and people who are not members of the military. So there are limits to the jurisdiction of the UCMJ. In addition, over time, the UCMJ has evolved significantly and in many ways provides equal or more substantial protections to defendants than the federal criminal justice system. But, the real problem in many ways is that the Guantanamo detainees who are being put before military commissions are not being given the protections either of the federal criminal system or of the UCMJ. I mean, it's a second-class system that's been, put into place it's, you know, through tinkering, it's gotten better. But again, but it remains a second-class system, and that's the, you know, that's the whole reason for having it.
Well, thanks very much. I'm glad you're working on these questions. They seem important.
All right. Thank you for the call. Just very quickly, I want to introduce again the guest, Jonathan Hafitz. He is Associate Professor of Law at Seton Hall University School of Law and has litigated a number of leading habeas corpus detention cases. His book is Habeas Corpus After 9/11, Confronting America's New Global Detention System, published by New York University Press. We have about 5 minutes left and another caller here in Belgium, nearby, line number 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. Doesn't this really come down to the fact that we had an ill-conceived war, unfunded war, that has led to problems that we have clear to today in economic terms, and it was totally hastily conceived and hastily persecuted after a group that wasn't a sovereign nation? We should have gone after the right people at the right time, and none of this would have been a problem.
I think a key problem is you know, how we conducted detentions that arose from the military operations. I mean, in the book, I don't, you know, really get into the question of the military strategy per se, but you know, simply accept, you know, the premise that, you know, after 9/11, the there was grounds to launch some military operations in Afghanistan. And to me, the bigger, you know, the bigger question is what happened, you know, in terms of detention, is what happened next. I mean, what happened when we captured people? How are we going to treat them? And the big problem was that we rather than trying to find an approach that was consistent with the rule of law, we turned our backs on the rule of law as a nation, created, you know, offshore detention sites like Guantanamo to hold people without protections, without access to a court, in good part to engage in harsh interrogation tactics that, you know, bordered on and in some instances amounted to torture, and, you know, to create this kind of system of prisons beyond the law, which to some extent still endure today. And you know, to me, that's you know, a key failing of our approach. And I think, you know, President Obama sounded the right notes when he talked about the idea of national security and constitutional values as reinforcing each other, that the best way to protect our security was to uphold our constitutional values and uphold human rights. However, I think there's been, you know, disappointment in terms of how the president has you know, put these goals into practice or not put them into practice in terms of continuing some of the practices of the prior administration, like military commissions and indefinite detention, and, you know, failing to close Guantanamo, which, you know, above all, has become a symbol throughout the world of the problems and abuses under the Bush administration.
Yeah. I want to thank the caller here. We're coming down to just a couple of minutes, and there's one last point I'd like to return to, that, you know, the administration, if they were to close Guantanamo, at least if they were going to close it anytime soon, would have to have someplace else to put these detainees, either temporarily or permanently. There was apparently an agreement, or seemed to be an agreement, actually, to move them here to Illinois, to an unused prison that we had here. There apparently, though, was enough opposition to that in Congress that essentially they have brought that to a close by saying to the administration, well, we're not going to appropriate the money for it. So without somebody paying the bills, then it looks like that's just not going to happen.
Yes, the plan was to try to bring some, you know, Guantanamo detainees to the U.S. for a continued detention. But Congress has, you know, effectively blocked that through its appropriation power and now through legislation that prohibits the, you know, bringing of detainees to the U.S. For any purpose. So politically, I think, and practically, it's dead in the water. The idea of bringing detainees to the U.S. is dead in the water right now. I'd only add that I think that, you know, bringing detainees to the U.S. for continued confinement at, you know, Thompson, Illinois, where it was administration had been planning to take them, would have addressed only part of the problem, really. I mean, it would have, closing Guantanamo and shutting the prison there would have been significant in that it would have helped to end a symbol of, you know, the abuse of executive power and human rights violations. But if you only, you know, close the prison to create a new Guantanamo or Guantanamo North in the United States, where you essentially, you know, have the same system, the system of indefinite detention without criminal trial or full due process, you haven't really got at the root of the problem. So I think while it would be very positive to close Guantanamo, and I think that the failure to close is problematic on many levels, merely closing the prison would have been a step in the right direction, but would not have redressed some of the core underlying problems.
And just real quick, do you think that the intentions of the administration were good, and that one of the problems that they came up against was that it turned out to be a whole lot more difficult than they thought?
I think the intentions were good. I think that, but I think there was, there were problems and in terms of operationalizing the intentions. I think they didn't. The administration didn't move quickly enough in the space it had following Obama's inauguration before the sort of backlash was able to mount. And I think it didn't really take some of the key steps it needed to take. To me, one of the biggest failings was early on, there were a group of Guantanamo prisoners called the Uyghurs, who were from China. The government's long recognized they present no threat to the U.S. They're not enemy combatants. They can't be sent home to China because they would be imprisoned or mistreated there. And so what the Obama administration was considering doing was bringing them to the U.S. There was a community here in around Virginia that was going to take them in, and that would have been a huge step. It would have demonstrated to the rest of the world that the U.S. was putting its money, you know, where its mouth was in terms of closing Guantanamo, taking some of the responsibility on. It would have helped, you know, repatriate other prisoners. But once there was the beginning of a political backlash or outcry, the Obama administration, shut down the plan to bring the Uyghurs here, and sort of capitulated to the political pressures. And I think that was a big setback in terms of closing Guantanamo.
Well, pardon me for interrupting you there. We're just going to have to leave it there because I'm at the end of the time. Jonathan Hafitz is associate professor of law at Seton Hall. And thanks very much for talking with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. This is a show that we first broadcast on March 15th of this year. If you're interested in checking on the schedule to see what we'll be doing in the days ahead, you can go to the website. You will see that tomorrow morning, as it is the first Wednesday of the month, we'll be talking with Doyle Moore, the man we like to call our chef in residence. We've been doing that for a long time. It's always a lot of fun. And as it is now almost officially summer, we'll be talking about cooking outdoors. Then in the second hour, Seth Fletcher will be the guest. He's senior editor at Popular Science Magazine. We'll talk about his recent book, Bottled Lightning, Super Batteries, Electric Cars, and the New Lithium Economy. So you can learn about upcoming shows on the website and go back and listen to past programs you might have missed, wyll.illinois.edu.
This is Terry Gross. Often when I'm interviewing people on Fresh Air, they give me a different way of looking at the world.
We all thought our bike was cold in the rain, that our fish was lonely in a fishbowl, that a leaf would be afraid of heights when it fell. It's just the way we looked at things.
Join us for new ways of looking at things on Fresh Air.
Monday through Friday at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to enjoy the summer studio theater productions of Title of Show and QED, playing through the month of June. More information is available at krannertcenter.com.
That's it for us on Focus. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. It is 1 minute before noon. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana. Online at will.illinois.edu. In Kansas City, July wheat 906 and 3/4, down 36 and 1/4. September 926, down 35 and a half. In Chicago, the July wheat contract trading at 7.78, down 41 and three quarters. September, 8.27 and a quarter, down 41. July corn, 7.47 and a half, down 11. September, 7.13 and a half, down 14 and three quarters. December, 6.68 and three quarters, down 15 and a quarter. March, 6.78.